TED Audio Collective.
Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49% based on creditworthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
Hi, I'm Debbie Millman. Canva is great for designing visual content for work, no matter what industry or department you work in. Now, your next presentation with Canva Presentations. Start with a professionally designed template and use it as a springboard for your design. It's a serious time saver. Time to present but can't be there in person? Enter Canva Talking Presentations. Record yourself presenting and add your talking head to your slides so your audience can watch your perfected presentation anywhere, anytime. Start designing today at canva.com. Designed for work.
This is Design Matters with Debbie Millman from designobserver.com. On this program, Debbie Millman talks with designer Clement Mock about the early days of Apple Computer, the heady days of the software bubble, and the joys of working for Steve Jobs.
We were called bozos. We were incompetent. There was nothing that we did that was up to his standards.
Here's Debbie Millman.
Clement Mock has had an incredibly eclectic career. From his early days as a technology pioneer to today's totally digital companies employing thousands, Clement has staked out a role as a visionary entrepreneur and designer. Today, he is the reason phrases such as experience design, information architecture, interaction design, strategic design, interface design, and customer experience are part of our lexicon. In the early 80s, just a few years out of art school, Mock took a job at Apple Computer. As the creative director, he designed all aspects of the Mac experience, from packaging to manuals, and helped to develop the simple, friendly sensibility of the Mac that persists to this day. In 1988, Mock left Apple to create his own firm and went on to found several successful design-related businesses, which we're going to talk all about now. Clement Mock, welcome to Design Matters.
Thank you, Debbie.
So I read an article where you stated that from the time you were very young, you knew that you wanted to do something creative and there was really no other alternative for you.
I want to be an architect. And I would take sheets, bed sheets, and I would build these sort of connected spaces between my bedroom into my brother's bedroom and then into the bathroom. So it was just it was a lot of fun making things.
So you trained as a graphic designer in the late 70s at Art Center College of Design in California, but immediately moved to New York City after you graduated.
Right.
Why is that?
It was important to me to work with mentors and masters. And New York had a disproportionate number of masters.
And you've worked for quite a few of them. You landed your first job at CBS's advertising and marketing department.
Right.
Working not only for Lou Dorfman, but also with Paula Scher.
Paula was in the building, I guess.
Okay, so she was in the building.
Right.
That counts. But that was only after you attempted to get a job with Massimo Vignelli.
Right.
So I want to know more about what happened with your interview with Massimo and how you ended up at CBS.
Yeah, okay. When I got out of Art Center, the first person I called was Rita Sue Siegel.
So the headhunter, the famous headhunter.
The famous headhunter. I wasn't even 21 at that point. And I had this list of people that I want to see. And it's like, Clement, you're not going to see these people. So I think I took it upon myself to drop off my portfolio at Massimo's office. And at that point in the 80s, Massimo would not see anybody. And I guess I had dropped off the portfolio in the morning. And by the at the end of the day, when I picked up my portfolio, Massimo wanted to see me.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I was just floored. And actually sat down in his office, and Massimo was like, so why don't you open a firm? You're good enough. And it's like, no, Massimo, I need to learn from masters like you. And Massimo was like, at that point, Michael Beirut was at Massimo's office at that point. And he referred me to see Michael Donovan and Nancy Green.
So you worked at CBS for a little over 6 months, mm-hmm. and then found yourself suddenly back in a position to go and work for Michael Donovan and Nancy Green. How did that come about? How did that full circle happen?
I just sort of looked at where I was. Here I was 6 months, and I really didn't feel like my potential was tapped, and I wasn't doing the kind of work that I thought I would be doing. So I called up Michael Donovan and said, Michael, remember the phone call that you got from Massimo about a young designer? And I got hired.
Were you worried at that time that being at CBS for such a short amount of time would have represented something negative on your resume?
There was that fear, certainly. But I think the fact that I started at CBS in 1980 and then I leaped into the position in May in 81, it sort of, I could create,
fudge.
Yeah, I could fudge a bit, so.
Now, I read that when you were working for Michael and Nancy, that you said that working in a studio environment like theirs altered your perspective and opened your eyes to the different arenas of design you could be involved with, mm-hmm. and no longer felt constrained or pigeonholed as any one type of designer.
Yeah.
How did they do that for you?
What sewed me on Michael and Nancy and what they were doing was this notion that they were not doing graphic design. They were doing exhibit design. They were also doing multi-image shows. So not only did it sort of give me diversity, but an eye that, you can actually cross different medium. You can go from print to do multi-image shows, to do exhibits, the sort of extension of an idea and how you can apply that across different things.
It seems like the experience allowed you in some ways to realize that you didn't really have to be a subject expert, but that this way of design thinking mm-hmm. was a way of solving problems to any kind of endeavor.
Yeah. It was really about asking questions and asking the right questions and not be afraid that you don't know
I think that becoming a protege of sorts in a design studio for extremely worldly designers is an invaluable lesson
yeah.
for any designer, almost at any age.
Yeah.
Now, is it true that you went on vacation? You went on a vacation
right.
while at Donovan Green,
mm-hmm.
and while on vacation mm-hmm. in California, were offered a job at Apple Computer?
Yeah.
Okay, so you go on vacation, you're like, la-di-da, going back to California,
yeah.
like bump into somebody. It's like, hey, I'm working at this really cool computer company. Want to come work there?
No, it wasn't quite like that. Do you want to come down and see me? I've got, it's a company called Apple, and at that point it was Commodore, Atari, the same difference.
And you thought that they were kind of like in another Atari, Commodore kind
yeah.
of a, yeah.
Video game company,
right.
and I had no clue. And I went down thinking that, this is, since these companies were in the news for having sort of out of the ordinary working environment, that they have juice bars and video games and what have you. So I just thought, that'll be fun to go check it out.
But you turned them down. You turned down a job at Apple.
Yeah. I sort of went down there and they gave me a job offer and I was like, Cupertino? I mean, please. I'm a very snobbish about not being in New York. And it really wasn't until coming back to New York, having lunch with my friends, and it was my friend who told me, wasn't the founder of this company, wasn't he on the front cover of Time magazine? And I said, all right, I've got to go check this out. It was only maybe 2 or 3 months old, so I was able to find an old copy at the library. And sure enough, and I found out it was Apple Computer. This guy's on the front cover of Time Magazine, and there was this thing called Personal Computers, and I was like, okay. I want to work for someone, and once again, learning from someone who made a name of himself doing something really different.
So when you called them back and asked if the job was still available, you had a criteria that included working directly with Steve Jobs.
Yeah, I did. I mean, I called Tom Suter back.
Tom Suter was the creative director.
Yeah, and I was very insistent. Tom, I want to work with Steve Jobs.
You were 24 years old. Steve Jobs was only 3 years older.
Yeah.
And you went there actually thinking that you didn't think that he would teach you anything about design.
Right.
Why?
Well, I didn't think he would teach me anything about design because he was not a design master. I mean, no one knew he was a design master at that point. He was just an engineer wearing T-shirts and scruffy jeans, really sort of bad wardrobe.
this was before the turtleneck.
Before the turtleneck.
So what was it like working for Steve Jobs? There's the big question. What was it like?
Steve is every bit as mercurial as the media have portrayed him in the press as well as in the books. He is he has a very definite point of view of what he wants and what he sees, and you basically have to draw it out of his head. He has a thousand ideas, not all of them good, and when he is fixated on one idea, you have to convince him why it's right or wrong. And if you can't do that, then you're not right.
Were you ever able to convince him that something that you thought was right and he thought was wrong was actually right?
It took a year and a half before I got there.
Well, that's not that long in the grand scheme of things, given what I've read.
Right. But it also was a change in my mind as to how to approach explaining and defending my ideas. I think the first 3 months we did, Tom Hughes and myself didn't do anything right. We were called bozos. We were incompetent. And there was nothing that we did that was up to his standards.
Did you think that you were a failure? Did you think that you'd ever get to a place where you were no longer a bozo? Or did you believe that you actually were or weren't a bozo?
No, I think you start after 3 months, you actually have self-doubt. He is, after all, the chairman and CEO of the company and has this idea. And so after 3 months, we were banging our heads, 15 rounds, 16 rounds of comps. And I think Tom Hughes finally said, you know, Steve, we can't sort of do a guessing game every time we come in. So we need to have a better idea what you think is great design. And I don't remember which portfolio exactly, but I do remember Milton's portfolio, Woody Pertle's portfolio, and I think it was Ivan Shamayev's portfolio, and lay that out and ask Steve, are these great designs? And Steve's like, nah.
Really?
Nah, yeah, really.
Three of the most accomplished designers working then and now.
Yeah, and Steve said, and Steve turned to us and said, well, why do you think these are great? And then we started talking about the quality of the work, craftsmanship, insight, and all the attributes that we thought were great design. And he basically said, yeah, Clement, yeah. But what I think great design is, and that's like, okay, well, waiting. It was the Beatles.
Okay.
So we were just, stunned that it was just out of left field. And then he said a pause and it's like, and thought about it and said, it's not the late Beatles, it's the early Beatles. Okay. So we were just sort of waiting and trying to understand what about this particular period of the Beatles that has anything to do with design. And he said, well, it's the raw energy, the verve, the vibrancy of their music. that should be the characteristics and the expression of what the Mac is, and that these were true artists. So, you know, that was what he thought great design was.
Did you agree with him?
We were puzzled.
See, it's funny because I would have thought he would have said the late Beatles, mostly because of the artistic experimentation. Mm-hmm. But I guess he was looking more for the, as you said, the energy.
Yeah.
How did you
What was the intensity? And then I think there was also another meeting where he kept referencing the restaurant Chow in San Francisco. And we're like, well, what about this restaurant? Is it an Italian restaurant? What part of this that is just sort of appropriate for the Macintosh? It's the feeling of the space. And I was like, really? Okay. So we did go to Chow, looked at what was there, and it was a white tile environment, and it was a script, very casual scripted logo for Chow. That was it. And that was what he felt appropriate.
Did you understand that? Did you agree with him?
Absolutely not. No idea. Absolutely no. And I think we spent a good couple of months mimicking, trying different combinations of all the different white background, scripted logos, but we really didn't quite understand the thought that technology is an art form. And I think it was Tom Hughes who kind of picked up on this when he was working on a script and hearing Steve Jobs talking about engineers and programmers or artisans. And then at that point, I said, okay, so we're really talking about technology as a form of art, and it needs to be expressed as a form of art.
After the year and a half that it took for you to gain Steve's respect, what was the sort of tipping point moment wherein that occurred? Like, what happened
that
suddenly gave him a sort of pause about your real talent?
Well, it's a love-hate relationship, and I think many people who have worked with Steve
had
that experience. So you do respect the fact that he pushed you to the point that you just sort of go, you do your best work for him. But it really was not until I got off the Macintosh team and I had a chance to be on my own and working on Apple's annual report for 1984. And at that point, I basically said, you know, I'm not going to please Steve. I'm going to do what's right. And I'm, because I was not under the Mac division, so in a lot of ways, I actually have a little bit more wriggle room in terms of what I can do and cannot do. And I came to the realization, and I think watching how other people got their ideas through is just so that you can be very sure that it was a right idea, and that you believe in your heart of heart it's the right solution, and you tell him why. And he could see that. If you're very firm in your belief and that this was the right solution, he'll let it go. And having that experience and going through the approval process with Steve on the annual report, and I was like, oh, it doesn't have to be so difficult in guessing what's in Steve's head. It's just that you have to be very passionate and convinced that you are doing the right thing.
You've said that working at Apple was very much a postgraduate course in marketing and business for you.
Yeah.
And that it tested your beliefs about what's good and what's bad.
Yeah.
How did it help you form your beliefs about what was good and what was bad?
The notion what good is relative to what you know. And since it is a new category, new marketplace, you actually get to set your own rules. So if you're first to market, you're first in the category, you get to define the rules of the game. And I think in a lot of ways, that really shaped how I would look at a problem. You know, can we reshape the conversation, reframe the conversation in such a way that we can be setting new standards and setting new rules?
I read an interview where you talked about what you learned from Steve, and you stated, I now know that Steve taught me how to design an idea. Mm-hmm. You design the inside, the outside, and everything around, and God willing, you design what's being said about it.
Yeah.
When Steve Jobs used the word design, he was advocating the whole user or brand experience, everything from the hardware, software, communication, advertising, and user experience design. He was years ahead in thinking about how design should be, and in the process convinced those of us who worked for him back then that we too could change the world. And you did, Clement. You really did. Did you have any sense at the time that you were doing this?
Not initially. I think it really was after the launch, and perhaps the first month after the post-launch, that I just said, oh, this is kind of big.
You think?
Yeah, but at the same time, there was also a big letdown at that point, too. And the market took a little while to also really understand what the technology was all about. So I think if you go back to 1985, Apple had a very bad year. The sales was off, and people absolutely thought the Macintosh was a toy. And I think it's looking back that you realize, yeah, this was kind of big.
So you worked at Apple from 1982 to 1988.
Yeah.
And you worked on over 1,000 projects mm-hmm. while you were there. And then you left to found your own firm.
Yeah.
And I read that you said that starting your own business was about following your heart.
Mm-hmm.
And how so? What did you hope to accomplish?
For me, at least at that point in the late 80s, the most interesting things were really happening in software.
When you were 30 when you started your own business.
Yes, I did.
Have you ever worried, Clement? Have you ever been worried about your future or whether or not you were going to be successful?
Fear, absolutely terrified, because I sold all of my Apple stock, bought my first LaserWriter and a Mac, all on employee discount, and started my own firm in San Francisco.
3 years after you opened the doors to Clement Mach Designs, you had already outgrown your space.
Mm-hmm.
You were a studio of over 20 people. How did you manage that kind of rapid growth?
It's called a shoebox. You move you move money from one box, the inbox, into the outbox. And good boy, manage would be too polite of a word.
And you changed the name of the company from Clement Mach Designs to Studio Archetype.
Mm-hmm.
From what I understand, within a year of your doing that, your headcount had grown to more than 100 and your revenues to more than 20 million.
Mm-hmm.
What made you decide to change the name and what catapulted you into that stratosphere?
Having seen what had happened with the Mac, being the first player out there doing the first thing, you get to set the bar. And that was great. And I was, and I think as a result, I was very addictive to doing new software company, new startup companies.
I actually remember the day that I first heard about you selling your company to mm-hmm. Sapient.
Mm-hmm.
Because you suddenly weren't a designer anymore. You were an entrepreneur. And you were a successful entrepreneur in a space that very few designers were even working in, let alone understood.
Mm-hmm.
So you went from being the CEO of your own company to being the chief creative officer of a brand new organization, merged organization.
An IT company and a management consulting company.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So what was that transition like for you?
It was, well, for me personally, it was just, it was an amazing learning experience, but it was pure hell for everyone who worked with me. There was a huge cultural clash between the left brainers and the right brainers of these two companies. And we missed that when we did due diligence.
Well, that's also very typical of any type of acquisition. The cultural part is the hardest part. And there really aren't a lot of manuals out there for how to survive or yeah. navigate that
right.
type of situation. How long did you stay at Sapient?
Till 2001.
So you took it all the way through the internet
yeah,
bubble.
Absolutely.
Now,
yeah.
This is funny. I read that after Sapient and during the period of the post-internet bubble, you decided you needed a rest
yeah.
and wanted to do something to ground yourself. So you went and became the president of AIGA. the largest professional organization of design in the world. That was a big job to take as a period of grounding yourself.
AIJ at that point was an organization, and it continues to be an organization in transition. And having been involved with a company like Sapien, dealing with culture and change, designers working with technology, and the challenges, you know, in the 3 years that I was with that company, I learned a great deal about change management. And I was like, I wonder if I can sort of shift that learning and trying to draw that out and model that for AIJA as an organization.
Well, you also created a number of other businesses at that time, CMCD, which is a stock photography company, and NetObjects, mm-hmm. which it's hard for me to explain what it is, but I guess would the best way to describe it be a web authoring application?
Yeah. I mean, the way that we looked at it initially when we started the NetObjects was PageMaker for the web.
So you're a bit of a serial entrepreneur.
Parallel serial entrepreneur.
So you're now a partner in Sugarfish, which is the collaboration of Kazunori Nozawa, legendary owner of Sushi Nozawa, as well as the technology and new media entrepreneur, Jerry Greenberg, who is also the co-founder of Sapient.
Yeah.
So your sort of life has come full circle in many ways.
Right.
How do you go about creating a brand for a restaurant?
The goals were pretty audacious.
What were the goals?
Changing the way how Americans think about sushi. And I think most people think about sushi as the things that you can get out of the supermarket.
In cellophane wraps. Nori wraps.
Yeah. Or the things that have cream cheese in there and
fake crappy.
Yeah, all of that stuff. And Chef Nozawa was one of the few chefs in the U.S. that sort of brought this notion of traditional sushi where the chef dictates what you have. You don't get an option to order what you like. No one showed up at his place for a good number of months.
How did he manage to survive?
Stubbornness. And sort of this notion that what he's doing is the right thing. And it's the integrity and the principles of serving the fish the right way and having respect for the food. So in the interim 40 years, he had developed a cult following in Los Angeles, and he was known as the Sushi Nazi in Los Angeles. He's been known to kick out celebrities and people who are just being rude and disrespectful in the restaurant. So we want to take that as a brand attribute and sort of repackage it in a user-friendly version. And it's really taking his style of sushi with a softer touch in terms of the user experience. And create the entire experience around the fish, eating fish as an experience.
So it's really bringing together all of your talents over your entire career.
A little bit of all of the above, yeah.
One of the really extraordinary things about your career is how you have built from one thing to another these successful entrepreneurial, creative endeavors.
Mm-hmm.
What do you foresee coming next?
Follow your heart. Follow my heart. Yeah.
Clement, your legacy has changed the way we practice and understand design. Thank you for being on Design Matters.
Thank you.
To learn more about Clement Mock and to watch a TED Talk, visit clementmock.com. I'd like to thank you for listening, and remember, we can talk about making a difference, we can make a difference, or we can do both. I'm Debbie Millman, and I look forward to talking with you again soon.
Design Matters with Debbie Millman is recorded at the Masters in Branding Studio at the School of Visual Arts in New York City. It is produced by Curtis Fox Productions. The show is published exclusively by DesignObserver.com. You can subscribe to this free podcast in the iTunes Store.
You're growing a business, and you can't afford to slow down.
If anything, you could probably use a few more hours in the day. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate, no coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.